a smile all over her face too, pinned a yellow rose on his lapel, and walked behind him, carrying the remnants of the cake. There was no sense in wasting it, as he strode out to the long limousine with the chauffeur holding open the door, and was driven down to the Mayflower, where Scooter was arranging and rearranging the big bouquet of yellow roses that the Nixons had sent, and where Dale had been nervously telling the band for an hour that he wanted the Yellow Rose of Texas to be struck up the instant Senator Johnson appeared. The party was perfect, too. Everyone was there. A dozen ambassadors. There was a brief ceremony when the Korean ambassador made him an honorary citizen of that nation. Washington royalty, the Kafritzes and Pearl Mesta. Texas royalty, as well as the man who mattered most to Lyndon Johnson. Sam Rayburn had a rare smile on his face, and a present that said a lot about this gruffly sentimental man's feeling toward Johnson. It was a set of gold cufflinks and shirt studs that he had, years before, given as a very special gift to his friend Auburn Barkley. Barkley's widow Jane had given them back to Rayburn when Barkley died, and Rayburn said he wanted Lyndon to have them now. Accepting the gift, Johnson told Rayburn, "I don't know of anyone for whom I have had more affection in my 49 years than for you. But the greatest thing you have ever done is what you and 12 other Texans did today when you voted as you did on this civil rights bill." And then there was a moment that was the perfect ending to the perfect day. All that evening, back in the Senate office building, Walter Jenkins had been on the telephone to Wisconsin, where the special election to fill Joe McCarthy's seat had been held that day. All evening, the news had been getting better and better, and just before midnight it was confirmed, and Jenkins telephoned Johnson at the Mayflower just moments before William Proxmire did so himself. "Senator Johnson," Proxmire said, "I've got the biggest birthday present of them all for you. Me." Proxmire had indeed pulled off the upset victory and would be the 50th Democratic senator. Even if Matthew Neely died, as indeed he would 4 months later, Johnson would still be majority leader. When Proxmire gave him the news, Lyndon Johnson said, "Well, the people of Texas have been awfully good to me for a long time, but I must say I never expected this much kindness from the people of Wisconsin." He was almost beside himself with joy. The next evening, while he was in the Senate cloakroom waiting for Thurmond to finish his filibuster, he sent an aide to find out when Proxmire was planning to come to Washington, and was told he was already on his way, that he was flying in that night and was expected to arrive shortly. He hustled the nearest 5 senators out to his limousine and off to National Airport, where they were waiting on the tarmac to welcome the Proxmires when they came down the stairs from the plane. Seeing Proxmire there in the flesh, the living proof that he would still be majority leader when Congress reconvened in 1958, Johnson couldn't do enough for him. He announced that he would give the newest senator a luncheon to celebrate his swearing-in the next day. A lunch for 100 people in the grandest setting he could provide, the old Supreme Court chamber. And he gave him the committee he wanted, banking and currency. As soon as he took his desk after the swearing-in, Proxmire asked for recognition from the chair and said that he knew it was tradition for a new senator to remain silent for a while, but that he felt it was his duty to thank Johnson for the fine things that the majority leader has done for us. Johnson jumped up to reply. Was Proxmire thanking him for the things he had done? He would do more. He announced on the spot that he was giving the newest senator the most prized junket he had available, a trip to West Germany at the invitation of the West German Bundestag. Reporters watching Lyndon Johnson saw a man transfused with happiness. As Mary McGrory wrote in the Washington Star, "Leadership of a Senate majority is not among the usual remedies prescribed for victims of a heart attack. In this case, it seems to have been good medicine." "Johnson works very hard," McGrory wrote, "but he works hard because he enjoys it. One gets the impression that no matter what the future may hold, Senator Johnson right now would rather be Senate Majority Leader than anything else in the world." Lyndon Johnson's exultation was justified for many reasons, but one of them was not the effectiveness of the bill he had gotten passed. To excuse its inadequacies, his partisans in later years would argue what Joe Rao argued at the time. that little as it was better than nothing. There was a phrase that summed up that argument, half a loaf is better than none, and the phrase could be employed to evoke poignant overtones. It seems to me, George Reedy said, that people who sneer at half a loaf of bread have never been hungry. The validity of this metaphor to describe the Civil Rights Act of 1957 was undercut, however, by the Act's results. For in terms of what was needed to bring justice to black Americans, the Act was not half a loaf of bread or even a slice. Hubert Humphrey had described it more accurately when he called it a crumb. Even before it was signed, events overtook it. On September 3rd, 5 days after the final Senate vote had sent the measure to the White House for signature, but before Eisenhower had signed it, Governor Orville Faubus of Arkansas had, as Stephen Ambrose writes, presented Eisenhower with exactly the problem he had most wished to avoid, outright defiance of a court order by a governor. And after 3 weeks of further defiance, all the controversy that had surrounded Part 3 became moot. Richard Russell had said that if Part 3 was passed, it would give the president power to enforce school desegregation with federal bayonets. Part 3 had been removed. But on September 24th, the president nonetheless enforced school desegregation with bayonets, sending 1,000 paratroopers of the 101st Airborne Division, bayonets fixed, into Little Rock to ensure the safety of 9 Negro school children who wanted to attend Central High School. At least part of the blame for the crisis has to be laid at the president's doorstep. As Ambrose was to write, by allowing events to run their course, by attempting to negotiate with Faubus, by failing to ever speak out forcefully on integration or to provide real leadership on the moral issue, he found himself in precisely the situation he had most wanted to avoid. His options had run out. He had no choice but to use force. But when he decided to use it, there was no legal impediment. As Brownell had contended all along, the president clearly had the power to use force to compel obedience to a court order, with or without Part 3. Equally important, with Part 3 gone, the Civil Rights Act of 1957 dealt only with voting rights. The Act did not even pretend to deal with such manifestations of injustice as segregation in housing, in restaurants, in schools. When Johnson took Part 3 out of the House bill, he set back integration in the South for 7 years, Joe Rao was to say. Part 3 passed in 1964. The Part 3 that was taken out in 57, in essence, became a part of the 64 Act. But for 7 years, there was no federal power to bring injunction suits. As for Part 4, the amended Part 4, it proved to be all but useless, not only because local election officials, certain that they would still be tried by friendly juries, were emboldened to continue discriminatory election practices, but because of what would be called a lack of will within the administration to enforce that part. During its remaining 3 years in office, the Eisenhower Justice Department filed only 10 suits against Southern registrars for arbitrary refusals to register qualified Negroes. These suits were stalled by state judges. One Georgia judge ordered officials in Terrell County to withhold voter records from federal agents even if a special police force had to be enlisted, and presumably armed, to enforce that order. At the end of 1958, in the 8 southern states in which the Southern Regional Council was able to obtain official figures, not only had the number of registered black voters not risen, it had actually fallen. And those states did not include Mississippi or Alabama, probably the 2 most recalcitrant states, where no official registration figures were kept. At the end of 1960, the net gain in black registration in the old Confederacy appears to have been a flat zero. There were other reasons, however, to justify Johnson's sense of accomplishment. The Act was, after all, the first civil rights legislation that had been passed in 82 years, and that fact had tremendous significance. For decades, for more than 3/4 of a century, men and women, black and white, who fought for social justice had watched as civil rights bills died in the Senate, every bill without exception. Many supporters of civil rights no longer believed that a civil rights bill would ever be passed by the Senate. The Civil Rights Act of 1957 changed that, as Lyndon Johnson tried to explain to journalists and liberals who criticized its inadequacies. "It's just a beginning," he told them. "We've shown that we can do it. We'll do it again in a couple of years. Critics of the act were right in claiming that it contained only limited substance, but they failed to recognize the irrelevancy of the point, George Reedy was to write. The crucial significance of the Civil Rights Bill was that it opened a major branch of American government to a tenth of the population for which all legislative doors had been slammed shut since 1875. And once the doors were opened, it would be impossible to close them again. Johnson believed that if he got one Civil Rights Act through, he could get more. He felt if you could get something through, it would be no longer a question of yes or no, but how much. Lyndon Johnson tried to explain this over and over again to the journalists and liberals who criticized the bill at the dinner parties he attended. "We've started something now," he would say. "Don't worry, it's only the first. We know we can do it now. We know the ropes." He was right. After decades, generations in which the Great Dam had been impenetrable, the sharp point of a wedge had now been hammered into it. The point could hardly have been tinier, but once the point of a wedge is hammered in, the rest of the wedge will, sooner or later, follow. Getting the first act through, starting something, was important for another reason. If half a loaf is an invalid metaphor with which to justify the Civil Rights Act of 1957, there is another metaphor which, though even more amorphous, is more justifiable when there is taken into account the effect of the bill's passage on men and women who for so long had watched every other bill die in the Senate. The opening of legislative doors that had been slammed shut since 1875 meant, Reedy says, that perhaps other laws, stronger laws, could be passed someday, and the impact of this upon people who had previously been denied participation in the institutions that ruled over them was extraordinary. On the afternoon of the day on which the Senate was passing the Civil Rights Bill, Robert Gretz, a white minister whose Montgomery home had twice been dynamited because of his support of the bus boycott, was talking to Murray Kempton. Kempton, having observed the Senate in action, was pessimistic about the prospects of future legislation, but Gretz said that now that one bill was being passed, soon there will be a strong voting rights bill, and then sooner than you think there will be Negro representatives in the legislature. Kempton said that this seemed like a wild dream. "Perhaps it is," Gretz said, "but if we did not believe it, we could not live here, and we would be wrong to be as happy as we are." The Civil Rights Act of 1957 was more than half a loaf, a lot more. It was hope. And there were still other reasons for Lyndon Johnson to be exultant. In 1957, great historical forces, a rising demand for social justice, a new militancy among blacks, new political equations that endowed the black vote with new significance, had come together in a tide sweeping toward the enactment of new civil rights legislation. But great forces had swept forward before, and always, if they reached the Senate, they had been blocked by the Senate. Had it not been for Lyndon Johnson, they would have been blocked by the Senate again. At the moment that he stepped wholeheartedly into the civil rights fight, these forces had seemingly been blocked by the Senate again. That they had in some measure been victorious in that body, and therefore in government as a whole, had been due to him. He had understood the forces. The world is moving to the left, you can either move with it or be crushed, and had ridden them, and at the same time had directed them into channels that made it possible for them to flow forward and win for social justice a beachhead staging area from which, the next time the forces came together, they could advance still further. The direction that he had given these forces and the maneuvers he had made on their behalf had all been legislative in nature. During the civil rights fight of 1957, Lyndon Johnson had displayed, in discovering underneath the seemingly impenetrable Southern defiance a weak spot, voting, on which Southerners might yield, in locating underneath the impassioned Northern rhetoric an area, loss of the right of jury trial, in which some Northerners felt themselves on weak moral ground, and in using these two points of vulnerability to carve out, amendment by amendment, an area of reconciliation that could attract a majority. In doing all this, he had displayed a remarkable ability in that most vital of legislative arts, the art of compromise. In seeing the need to bring together the South and the West, and in recognizing in the Hell's Canyon Dam the means of bringing them together, he had displayed a mastery of legislative strategy on a grand, nationwide scale. By grasping in a moment on the Senate floor the possibilities in Clint Anderson's amendment, by seizing that moment before it could vanish from the floor, by delicately adding jury trial amendment after jury trial amendment until he finally had the amendment that would attract enough votes to let the bill pass, he had displayed a mastery of small-scale, intricate legislative maneuver. In a republic which had, during the past century of its existence, grown accustomed to thinking of governmental leadership almost solely in terms of executive leadership, he had provided a vivid demonstration of the potentialities in legislative leadership. A master of a profession cannot but know he is a master, cannot but feel joy and pride in exercising that mastery. Lyndon Johnson knew what he had done and gloried in what he had done. So I went to a few key Southerners and persuaded them, and then in return I got the Western liberals, and then I was able to show that as long as they trusted me. His triumph was a triumph of something even larger than legislative expertise and leadership. The common ground on which he had at last brought both sides together was not ground he had discovered, but ground he had created. The bill he had gotten passed might still bear the number, H.R. 6127, that it had been given in the House of Representatives when it was still the Eisenhower administration's bill, but it bore little resemblance to the bill drawn up by Attorney General Brownell. The excisions in and amendments to it that Lyndon Johnson had fashioned had been so substantial that the bill was in effect a new bill, in whose creation he had had the major hand. The Civil Rights Act of 1957 was therefore a demonstration not only of legislative expertise and leadership, but of legislative creativity, of creativity on a very high order. And this was a demonstration that was badly needed. As C. Van Woodward, perhaps the nation's preeminent historian of Southern history, wrote in the October 1957 issue of Commentary, "The trouble was not in the House of Representatives, which frequently yielded to the pressure, but in that formidable institution, the United States Senate. Moving between the incorrigible right and the immovable left, Senator Johnson worked mainly in the shifting center to shape and mold a workable compromise to replace a futile stalemate. The air of compromise is rarely appreciated fully by men of principle, and working out this compromise was very difficult. Its success called for political astuteness on Johnson's part amounting to genius. The senator, it proved, had what it took." On the Sunday after the Act's passage, the great media organs that set the liberal tune pulled out all the stops. There was so much praise in the New York Times and the Washington papers that it couldn't be confined to one section. The Post, that Sunday, carried not only an editorial that reflected Philip Graham's opinions, Mr. Johnson came out of the debate a national rather than a regional figure, but under the headline, "Johnson's Masterpiece," a political analysis by Robert Albright. "The Senate last week did an incredible thing. Famed for his legislative miracles, this beyond any doubt was Johnson's masterpiece." And in the Society section, a long profile by Mary Van Rensselaer Thayer that began, "This but definitely is LBJ week." In the Washington Star, there was an editorial, as well as an analysis of his tactics by David Kuntz. Some of the veteran observers in the Senate press gallery confidently expected to be writing about a civil rights filibuster for weeks and months. Everybody knew there would be a filibuster. Everybody, that is, except Lyndon Baines Johnson. And a long profile in the Society section by Liz and Leslie Carpenter. A few days later, the New Republic weighed in. Moderates of both parties share a feeling of triumph. The leaders were thoroughly reasonable men. Here was bipartisanship at its best. Douglas Cater of the Reporter, so critical of Johnson in the past, now extended himself to make amends. Reedy had written a long memorandum and given it to Cater for background, and Cater asked permission to use sentences from Reedy's memo as if Johnson himself had spoken them to him, Cater, in an interview. Reedy edited the quotes. "I think it is all right providing the words I have bracketed in the first paragraph are eliminated," he told Johnson. and Cater used them as edited, no matter how they distorted reality. His article said, "Johnson remarked to me recently, it was realized that there could be no compromise in the sense of an empty and evasive deal. Everything that happened, short of technical drafting work, took place right on the Senate floor in plain sight of the press and public." The article as a whole substantially revised Cater's earlier view of Johnson. And there was praise for Lyndon Johnson in publications that had very seldom bestowed praise on him in the past. The publications that he needed. Senator Lyndon Johnson's performance in driving the Right to Vote bill through the Senate is the most remarkable feat of political generalship in years. Johnson is a spectacular operator. Those sentences came from the AFL-CIO News. The AFL-CIO? Meanie. Labor. Labor, which always liked liberals, and which had never liked him. That Sunday, he sat at home watching the morning television shows on which he was invariably praised, and on Monday morning there was a memorandum from Willie Day Taylor on shows he hadn't been able to watch. Senator Bible was also complimentary of your leadership on WTOP's City Side. Columnists compared him favorably to America's great legislative leaders of the past. Majority Leader Lyndon B. Johnson is now recognized as a modern Henry Clay, the great compromiser on the issue of slavery, said Ray Tucker. No wonder he was exultant, euphoric. Just before he left for Texas, Joseph C. Duke, the Senate sergeant-at-arms, presented him with a large American flag, together with a letter to certify that the enclosed flag was flown over the Senate wing of the United States Capitol from the 1st to the 30th of August, 1957, during which period was adopted by the United States Congress the Civil Rights Bill. Lyndon Johnson took the flag back to the ranch with him, and on his first morning home, Lady Bird had it raised to the top of the tall flagpole on the front lawn. It fluttered there against the sky, that brilliant blue sapphire hill country sky, so often cloudless in summer, that had spelled doom for his father and his father's father. When he had been a boy, Lyndon had watched his father and mother look up at that sky, hoping in vain for a sign of the rain that could save their land. He had looked up at it himself then, in vain. When he looked up now, the blue in the flag was deeper than the sky's blue, and across the sky's pitiless brightness, broad red and white stripes waved triumphantly. Sapphire blue no longer doom, but only background. Liberal suspicion of Lyndon Johnson had not been completely dissipated, though. Far from it. Even during the first chorus of praise, there were dissenting voices. Some of the liberal senators who had fought to the end for a stronger bill were unable to reconcile themselves to the one that had passed, feeling the public had been led to believe it would achieve at least small advances in civil rights, while they felt that in fact there was no chance of that. Wayne Morse, urging Eisenhower to veto it, called it a hoax and sham bill. And they were bitter about Lyndon Johnson. Johnson, Paul Douglas was to write, somehow emerged from the shadows of opposition as the great apostle of civil rights. The bill was a triumph, so he said, for his policy of moderation over the extremists, who would have prevented action by their wild talk. Some of his favorite columnists, including William S. White, burst into a chorus of antiphonal praise. Somehow I now became the man who had impeded progress. Johnson, our opponent, became in their version the great hero. Not all liberal newspapers saw good in the bill, or in the man who had masterminded its passage. The moderate Texas leadership seems willing to sacrifice anything except party unity, the Detroit News editorialized. Liberals at their dinner parties still argued among themselves about the bill and about Lyndon Johnson. Bethune Church would never forget the explosion of pent-up anger with which Clayton Fritchie, director of the Democratic National Committee's Public Affairs Division, greeted her husband when, at a Georgetown party, Frank walked through the front door. Or how Fritchie continued, for hours it seemed, to assail Frank in a brutal, brutal argument for helping to pass the jury trial amendment. Some of his, Church's, liberal friends thought it was the damnedest sellout in history, his aide John Carver would recall. Paul Douglas used a memorable phrase. The bill, he said, reminded him of Lincoln's old saying that it was like a soup made from the shadow of a crow which had starved to death. Within a day, it seemed, that saying was being repeated over dinner tables in Georgetown and Cleveland Park. And as time passed and the ineffectiveness of the act became increasingly evident, liberal criticism was to grow louder. Nonetheless, while after the 1957 Civil Rights Act there remained substantial liberal suspicion and criticism of Lyndon Johnson, there was not nearly so much as there had been before. At least some of the Southern stigma, the fatal smell of magnolias, had scrubbed off. Philip Graham had felt that for Johnson to become president, he had to be cleaned up on civil rights, and that cleaning up had gotten off to a good start. Among the signatures at the bottom of the letters to the editor that appeared in newspapers during and just after the 1957 civil rights fight were names with real significance to liberals. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now. Master of the Senate by Robert A. Caro. Part 3. Continued. Cassette 13, Side 2. Among the signatures at the bottom of the letters to the editor that appeared in newspapers during and just after the 1957 civil rights fight were names with real significance to liberals. One letter argued that the Senate bill may not go as far as many think it should, but its significance should not be minimized. If progress is to be achieved, differences as to what should be done must yield to a consensus as to what can be done. The letter assured friends and supporters of civil rights that they could support the bill with clear consciences, and the arguments and assurances were given weight by the signature at the end of the letter, Benjamin V. Cohen. Another letter was from Dean Acheson. I don't think it is an exaggeration to say that the bill is among the great achievements since the war, and, in the field of civil rights, the greatest since the 13th Amendment. Can't we for once be proud of ourselves when we do the right thing? Richard Rovere was to note in the New Yorker that if Mr. Eisenhower decides to sign the bill, he will have in common with Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman the experience of approving a piece of legislation whose vital and operative sections have come largely from the hands of Benjamin V. Cohen and Dean Acheson. That was a telling point for liberals. How could any true liberal ignore the opinions of men like Cohen and Acheson? When the American Civil Liberties Union denounced the bill, the New Republic denounced the American Civil Liberties Union. It took the U.S. Senate nearly 90 years to approve a civil rights bill, and it took the ACLU lawyers several hours to decide and notify the press that the bill was worse than nothing, a New Republic editorial said. Unprecedented progress has already been made, and the progress, the New Republic said, had been made because of Lyndon Johnson, who called on two of the New Deal's best draftsmen, Ben Cohen and Dean Acheson, for aid. And finally, there was, under the dateline Hyde Park, a word from the liberal whose word meant the most of all. She had been torn as to whether or not to support the amended bill, Eleanor Roosevelt wrote in My Day. It is one of those difficult decisions in which you know that the way you are voting may possibly injure the objective you are trying to attain. But, she said, she had finally decided that the civil rights bill with the amendment would be a small step forward, and I hope it will become law. And, of course, the NAACP and the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights had supported the measure. By passing the Civil Rights Act of 1957, Lyndon Johnson had obtained the political gain that his political ambition demanded. A moderate columnist, Roscoe Drummond, may have summed up the situation most definitively when he wrote, "If you think the Senate did wrong in cutting back the civil rights bill, much of the blame goes to Johnson. If you think the Senate acted responsibly and usefully in passing a compromise bill, much of the credit goes to Johnson. He proved himself the ascendant leader of the whole Democratic Party in Congress, Northern and Western liberals as well as Southern conservatives. Because he voted for and is an architect of the right to vote law, He is the first Southern Democratic leader since the Civil War to be a serious candidate for the presidential nomination. And there was yet another reason, the most important reason of all, that the Civil Rights Act of 1957 meant hope. There may have been only meager significance in the act itself, but there was massive significance in what the fight for the act's passage had revealed about the potentialities of the man who led that fight, about the possibilities that lay within that man for the advancement of social justice in America. In the great struggle for America's soul that was the Civil Rights Movement, extraordinary black leaders had already emerged, Randolph, Wilkins, Thurgood Marshall. And during the 1950s, of course, another figure, who would eclipse them all, was coming to the forefront among blacks. But as that leader, Martin Luther King, was to say, the evil of racial discrimination in America was so great that the Negro cannot fight it alone. Help was needed not only from among men whose skins were dark, but from among men whose skins were white. Leadership was needed, effective leadership. Leadership that not only enunciated ideals, but that made progress, limited though it might be, toward achieving them. It was needed particularly in the halls of government, because it could only be from those halls that laws, the only permanent remedy for injustice, could issue. And until 1957, governmental leadership was particularly lacking, its absence particularly glaring and destructive. Dwight D. Eisenhower declined to provide moral leadership on the fundamental moral problem of the time, and on Capitol Hill, the leadership of the fight for civil rights laws provided not laws, but only words. In 1957, however, effective leadership in the fight for civil rights laws had been provided by Lyndon Johnson. If he was not able to do more, if the leadership he had provided had been only on behalf of a weak bill, he had nonetheless done all he could, the most he could do in the position, majority leader of one of the two houses of Congress, in which he was situated. But what if he were to rise one day to another position? Lyndon Johnson was eventually to attain the post to which he had aspired all his life. And when he did, he would, as President of the United States, ram to passage the great Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965, legislation that would do much to correct the deficiencies of the 1957 legislation. He would give black Americans a Voting Rights Act that was truly meaningful, would make them, at last and forever, a true part of American political life. It was Lyndon Johnson, among all the white government officials in 20th century America, who did the most to help America's black men and women in their fight for equality and justice. It was he who was, among all those officials, their greatest champion. And it was in 1957, in that fight for the Civil Rights Act of 1957, that Lyndon Johnson's capacity to one day be that champion was first foreshadowed. The foreshadowing came not only in his drafting of the act and in his dealing and maneuvering, but perhaps most significantly in a speech he gave. The speech was delivered on the Senate floor. It came near the end of the 1957 fight, on the evening of August 7th. Sitting at his desk, just before the 72-18 final vote, he made a small gesture with his hand, and a blue-suited page carried over a portable lectern and placed it on the desk. Johnson laid the speech on the lectern, put on his thick-lensed glasses, and rose to read. Jim Rowe had told Lyndon Johnson that if he wanted to become president, he had to vote for a civil rights bill, to pass a civil rights bill, and to get the credit for that bill, and Johnson had done all those things. But Rowe had also told Johnson something else. "I know also that Lyndon Johnson is intellectually not a Southerner, but a national leader," he had said. The need for such a leader was terribly urgent, he said. There would be a very good chance to bury this plague of civil rights if only a national leader would step forward. And with this speech, Lyndon Johnson showed that, if he was still not yet such a leader, he had the potential to become one. In the speech, his first formal announcement that he would vote for the bill, he portrayed the measure in terms that would make it acceptable to his Texas constituency. "It repeals a bayonet-type Reconstruction statute," he said, "and under its provisions, basic rights, such as the jury trial, are re-emphasized and broadened." Such sentences were typical Lyndon Johnson sentences, the careful cliché formulas of a cautious politician. But there were other sentences in that speech. Some set forth the pragmatic philosophy that was part of Lyndon Johnson's most fundamental belief, a belief in the possible. In the past few days, there has been considerable discussion about the things which the bill does not do, he said. I am aware of those things. But, he said, I cannot follow the logic of those who say that because we cannot solve all the problems, we should not try to solve any of them. I can understand the disappointment of those who are not receiving all they believe they should out of this bill. I can understand but not sympathize with their position. The bill doesn't have to be perfect, Lyndon Johnson said. The possible necessity for change is no bar to action. The Senate will not disappear after the vote tonight. We shall be present throughout the years to come. And there were sentences that rose above pragmatism to something higher. Lyndon Johnson had, all his life, expressed a deep distrust of ringing phrases. But there were phrases in this speech that seemed to verge on what he had always said he distrusted. Out of this debate has come something even more important than legislation, Lyndon Johnson said. This has been a debate which has opened closed minds. This has been a debate which has made people everywhere examine hard and fast positions. For the first time in my memory, this issue has been lifted from the field of partisan politics. It has been considered in terms of human beings and the effect of our laws upon them. Then he turned to politics. There are, he said, people who are still more interested in securing votes than in securing the right to vote. There are people who are still more interested in the issue than in a solution to the issue. But I state, out of whatever experience I have had, that there is no political capital in this issue. Nothing lasting, nothing enduring has ever been born from hatred and prejudice, except more hatred and more prejudice. Look at the legislation passed during Reconstruction, Lyndon Johnson said. That legislation was born out of hatred. But, he said, we do not have to reconstruct Reconstruction in order to have a bill. We do not have to reopen the wounds. He wanted to remove politics from the civil rights issue, he said. There is no compelling need for a campaign issue. But, he said, there is a compelling need for a solution that will enable all America's people to live in dignity and in unity. And finally, Lyndon Johnson turned again to his own vote on the Civil Rights Act of 1957 and to his own feelings about that vote. He knew, he said, that his vote will be treated cynically in some quarters and it will be misunderstood in others. But the Senate has dealt fairly and justly with this measure. This is legislation which I believe will be good for every state of the Union. And so far as I am concerned, Texas has been a part of the Union since Appomattox. A part of the Union since Appomattox. That was a phrase that could rally men to a cause. When at last Johnson revealed his own feelings about the bill and said, so far as I am concerned, Texas has been a part of the Union since Appomattox, I was ready to commit myself to him, his ambitions and purposes, for the duration, his young aide Harry McPherson was to recall. The man who distrusted ringing phrases, who despised men who used such phrases, was using some himself now. In that moment it was even possible, seeing that tall man standing at that desk on the floor of one of the houses of the Congress of the United States and uttering such phrases, to picture that man standing one day on the dais of one of the houses of Congress and speaking not merely to his colleagues but to an entire nation in ringing phrases. Phrases like, "We shall overcome." Years later, years after the passage of the great Civil Rights Acts of Lyndon Johnson's presidency, Harry McPherson, who had served in Johnson's White House, would be riding in a parade in his native East Texas. There were floats in the parade and high school bands, and, McPherson realized, the bands were mixed. There was a Negro trombonist next to a white cornetist, three black drummers and a white cymbal player, and at the front of it all, black and white majorettes in perfect unison. There was a big sign on the side of the car in which McPherson was riding. It said, "Counsel to President Lyndon B. Johnson." And as the car passed, spectators pointed to the sign and quietly applauded. And then the car entered a Negro neighborhood. Suddenly there was more than applause. Men and women were cheering. They were waving at the car. and many of them were holding up their arms and with their fingers making the sign of V, V for victory. McPherson's eyes met those of an elderly black man. The man grinned at McPherson and nodded his head. "That's right," he said, "that's right." So there had been change, McPherson would write, so much that one could scarcely remember the careful, apprehensive steps which the Senate had taken in 1957, the struggle over Title III and the jury trials, the different words for Douglas and Irvin, the praise and resentment. But, McPherson says, it had all started there. The great Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1965 had all started there in 1957. That's right. That's right. Part 6. After the Battle. Chapter 42. 3 More Years. During Lyndon Johnson's next 3 years in the Senate, his final 3 years in the Senate, there would be a challenge to his style of leadership. In the 1958 elections, recession, growing unemployment, anger among farmers at President Eisenhower's veto of a bill to increase farm price supports, and at his Secretary of Agriculture, Ezra Taft Benson, and the revelation of influence peddling by the president's top aide, Sherman Adams, cost the Republican Party 48 seats in the House of Representatives and 12 in the Senate, including, improbably, even the Ohio seat that had been held by John W. Bricker. William Noland, having resigned, lost his race for the governorship of California. In 1959 and 1960, Democrats outnumbered Republicans by almost 2-1 in both houses of Congress, in the Senate by 64-34. Of the new Democratic senators elected, none were conservatives and 5 were liberals, eager, as Evans and Novak wrote, to make common cause with the tiny beleaguered faction of liberals who had been challenging Johnson's leadership. "You know there has been this undercurrent of emotion against your leadership in the last 6 years," Jim Rowe wrote Johnson shortly after the election. "It is much stronger today than it has ever been in the past." Within weeks of the election, this undercurrent had risen to the surface. A letter to Johnson from Joe Clark of Pennsylvania, demanding increased representation for liberals on the Democratic policy and steering committees, found its way into the press. Pat McNamara demanded more frequent caucuses. And several of the newly elected liberals, notably Edmund Muskie, who had broken the Republican hold in Maine by twice winning election as governor and then had defeated Republican incumbent Payne to win a Senate seat, and, surprisingly, William Proxmire, were unwilling to be relegated to the spear-carrier roles that Johnson's method of operation required. Offering Muskie advice on his Senate career, Johnson told him not to make up his mind on issues too early, to wait, in fact, until they get to the M's in the roll call. But when, a few weeks later, Johnson said he assumed Muskie would be supporting him in the first big Senate fight of January 1959, the attempt once again to amend Rule 22, Muskie responded by saying, "Well, Senator, I think I'll follow your advice and just wait until they get to the M's." And when he voted with the liberals, Johnson, while not throwing down his pencil, responded otherwise as angrily as he had with Frank Church. Bobby Baker was dispatched to tell other senators that Johnson considered Muskie a chicken shit. As for Proxmire, who had once called himself Johnson's biggest birthday present, he turned out to be a somewhat unwelcome gift. During his early days in the Senate in 1958, Proxmire had seemed willing to pay, in both silence and obsequiousness, the price for admission to the Senate club, entering debates only upon an invitation from a senior senator, scheduling his first major speech for the day before Easter recess, when most senators would already have left Washington and wouldn't have to listen to him, and tendering a strikingly full measure of deference to the majority leader at every opportunity. But he soon decided that the price was too high. Talking one day to an acquaintance about a freshman colleague who also spoke seldom, he exclaimed, "He might as well not be a senator." Proxmire decided, he was to say, to be a senator like Wayne and Paul, and became outspoken on the floor. In 1959, after Johnson refused his request for appointment to the Finance Committee, Proxmire felt the refusal was due to his opposition to the oil depletion allowance. Proxmire went further in a full-dress Senate speech attacking Johnson's leadership. "There has never been a time when power has been as sharply concentrated as it is today in the Senate," he said. At the first caucus he had attended, in January 1958, he said, "Senators assembled and listened to the majority leader read a speech which he had previously released to the press in full. There was not a single matter of party business discussed. There wasn't even a mention of a party program, not a whisper concerning any legislation. And the next meeting of the Democratic caucus wasn't until a full year later. Senators had to surrender for another year their right and duty to determine the Democratic Party's policies and programs." Proxmire then gave a series of talks attacking one-man rule in Congress, in the Senate by Johnson, in the House by Rayburn. "When you get these two men together with the power of making committee assignments, you see the obsequious bowing, scraping senators and congressmen around them. And demanding more frequent caucuses and larger, more Democratic Party committees." All during 1958, 1959, and 1960, the liberal attacks on Johnson continued. In January 1960, the liberals embodied in a formal resolution demands for more frequent caucuses, for selection of the policy committee membership by a vote of all Democratic senators instead of by the leader alone, and for the drawing up by the policy committee of a Democratic legislative agenda. And these attacks were treated by the Washington Press Corps as significant revolts against Johnson's leadership, with headlines and cutting cartoons. One by Herblock showed King Johnson on a throne with a spear knocking off his crown as he said, "Methinks, my lord, that the peasantry is getting restless." Johnson's grip on the reins of senatorial power, however, was far too firm for the attacks to have any real significance. He was stung by Proxmire's attacks into answering him on the floor, saying the Wisconsin freshman needed a fairy godmother or a wet nurse. "This one-man rule is a myth," he said. "I do not know how anyone can force a senator to do anything. I have never tried to do so. I have read in the newspapers that I have been unusually persuasive with senators. I have never thought these were accurate reports. Usually, when a senator wants something done and does not get his way, he puts the blame on the leadership. It does not take much courage, I must say, to make the leadership a punching bag." As for Clark, Johnson didn't deign to reply to him himself. He delegated that task to Majority Whip Mike Mansfield, who said that instead of restructuring the Senate, the Democratic senators should rely on the leadership and parliamentary skill of Lyndon Johnson. Johnson refused to meet any of the liberal demands. They had asked for more frequent caucuses. That first Democratic caucus of 1958, the one at which, in Proxmire's phrase, not a single matter of party business was discussed, was the only caucus held in 1958. In 1959, there was also only one caucus. Then, during the first days of January 1960, the Senate liberals determined to speak out and to make an all-out attempt at reform. At the Democrats' January 7th caucus, Clark introduced a resolution stating that if at least 15 senators requested a meeting of the Democratic Party caucus, one would be held every 2 weeks. A debate ensued, the more senior members generally speaking in opposition, as Clark recalls, until Johnson ended it by saying he would be happy to call a caucus any time at the request of even a single senator. Johnson was as good as his word, but he added some other words. During that January, he scheduled no fewer than 4 additional caucuses, but also let it be known that he would not be displeased if senators found they had better things to do. Attendance steadily declined. 60 of the 64 Democratic senators had come to that first January 7th caucus. By the January 20th caucus, attendance was down to 24. Another January caucus was attended by 38 senators, but, Clark was to say, only because it was an unusual case. It meant to discuss a bill close to floor action. And, Clark was to say, that was the end. The liberals did not even request another caucus, largely because those of us who wanted regular meetings became convinced that without leadership support, which was not forthcoming, we could not turn out enough members to make the conferences worthwhile. The liberals had proposed another resolution, that the policy committee be selected not by the leader but by an election. The vote on that resolution was 51-12, against it. Proxmire had to concede that despite 2 years of attacks, he had failed to make any real dent in Johnson's power. The Star's Washington Window column summed up the denouement of Proxmire's revolt against Lyndon Johnson. It had been a David and Goliath drama, but with a non-traditional ending. Instead of Goliath being slain, it was David who was slain. Talking with Proxmire, Richard Russell told him that his position reminded him of a bull who had charged a locomotive train. That was the bravest bull I ever saw, but I can't say a lot for his judgment. Throughout Lyndon Johnson's life, in every institution of which he had been a part, a similar pattern had emerged. As he rose to power within the institution, and then as he consolidated that power, he was humble, deferential, obsequious, in fact. And then, when the power was consolidated, solid, when he was in power and confident of staying there, he became, with dramatic speed and contrast, autocratic, overbearing, domineering. Now, during his final 3 years in the Senate, this pattern was repeated. The success of his leadership affected the Lyndon Johnson lifestyle visibly, George Reedy was to say. During his early years as leader, he put on a humble pie act that would have done credit to Ella Sinders. This faded overnight, and a major task of his staff was to keep the hubris from showing too much. This task was difficult. He already had an unprecedented amount of office space. Now he took over more, a lot more, not in the Senate office building, but in the Capitol itself. He already occupied most of the western end of the Capitol's gallery floor in the Senate wing, with his two-room majority leader's suite in G14 and his three-room policy committee suite in G17, 18, and 19. But between these two suites was a third, the only space on that end of the floor that he didn't occupy, a two-room suite, G15 and G16, filled with the staff of the Commerce Committee. Now he commandeered that as well, so that, as one reporter wrote, he will have a seven-room spread of offices replete with crystal chandeliers and rich furniture, occupying the entire Northwest Senate wing on the third floor of the Capitol. Sometimes, for a new visitor, he would sweep aside the heavy drapery behind his desk there, and suddenly the window would be filled, as one reporter wrote, with the marbled city below with its great avenues running toward the White House. Grand as this suite was, it was still too far from the chamber floor for his liking. But on the same level as the chamber floor, and conveniently near it, was a suite of two huge rooms that had been the staff and meeting rooms of the Senate's District of Columbia Committee. He commandeered that, too. On its high ceilings, above its big crystal chandelier, were frescoes, as soon as he chose the office, painters began touching them up, of boys carrying baskets of flowers and young maidens reclining on couches, a Roman emperor's banquet. Reporters began referring to it as the Emperor's Room, before coining another name which stuck, the Taj Mahal. Lady Bird imported an interior decorator from New York to redo the suite in green and gold. On entering the office, Sam Schaffer wrote, one was immediately confronted by an extremely well-lit, fully life-size portrait of its occupant, hung above its marble fireplace. The artist had portrayed Johnson leaning against a bookcase, but he had captured at least some of the piercing quality in Johnson's eyes. That huge picture of Lyndon looking squarely in the visitor's eye first thing on entering Lyndon's office is a sure irritant, John Steele reported in a memo to his editors at Time. And it was not only Lyndon Johnson's portrait that was well lit. High above the desk, concealed in the chandelier, two spotlights had been placed, focused so that as the man himself sat at the desk, they cast on him what one reporter called an impressive nimbus of golden light. In a corner of the immense room, he had ordered high walls of polished mahogany built, and behind them was a bathroom, a Johnsonian bathroom, a monument of a toilet, James Reston called it, used as Johnson used bathrooms. Soon, secretaries, assistants, and senators were having to take dictation from him or discuss issues with him as he sat before them on the toilet. Johnson made other changes, too, in that Capitol wing that was his world. When he came to the deserted capital on a Sunday, he sometimes had to wait a minute or two for an elevator, since only one elevator operator was on duty. Now the waiting time was eliminated. Three operators were on duty all Sunday. And the operators of the subway between the Capitol and the Senate office building no longer stopped working at 6 o'clock. They remained on duty until Johnson had left the Capitol. The pattern was discernible not only in the office, but in the way visitors to it were treated. Not the committee chairman, of course, but almost all his other colleagues. Often they were kept waiting. Sometimes there would be three or four senators of the United States cooling their heels in the majority leader's antechamber. Even the placid Mansfield once lost his temper over the length of time he was kept waiting for an audience and left, saying to Ashton Ganella, "Well, I'm not going to wait this long for anybody." Mansfield's attitude displeased Ms. Ganella. In recounting this incident, she told the author, "I did not like people who did not respect Mr. Johnson." While the time senators spent in the suite's outer office was sometimes uncomfortably long, the time they spent in the inner office was sometimes uncomfortably short. A request might be made of the leader, and it might be denied quickly and curtly, after which it was clear the applicant was expected to get up and leave. Lyndon Johnson's attitude toward his colleagues was increasingly proprietary and paternalistic. They were his children. It was his Senate, Ms. Ganella explains. Some of them were wayward children. That was all right. That was why he was there, the firm fair father, to see that they didn't get into trouble. In November 1958, he would tell John Steele, in an off-the-record interview, "You know, I feel sort of like a father to these boys. A father loves his sons, though one son may drink a little too much, another may neck with the girls a little too much. A good father uses a gentle but firm rein, checks his sons, guides them, and above all understands them." He knew what each of them needed. In 1958, he selected his new favorite, Frank Church, for the honor of reading George Washington's farewell address in the Senate on Washington's birthday. Telling a reporter why he had selected Church, he explained that he needed a bit of bringing forward, just like my daughter does at school. More and more, he was unguarded in his estimates of his colleagues' abilities and in his description of their relationship with him. After all, why should he watch his words? What could they do about it if they didn't like them? "Now, Allen," he said about Bible, said to a journalist, "Allen is a good mediocre senator. He'll do what I tell him." He let reporters know how cleverly he manipulated them. His attitude was also apparent in the terms in which he described his own activities. In January 1958, 2 days before the President's State of the Union address to Congress, Johnson delivered a speech to the Senate Democratic Caucus, instructing George Reedy to tell reporters it was Johnson's State of the Union address. Did a president have a cabinet? During the course of his speech, Johnson, as Time put it in a March 1958 cover story on him, hoisted himself to political heights without precedent by referring to himself, in effect, as President of the U.S., South Pennsylvania Avenue Division. "As majority leader of the Senate," said he, "I am aided by a cabinet made up of committee chairmen." Doris Fleeson might poke fun at his pronouncements, asking if he had worked out a disability agreement with his second-in-command, Mansfield. But most of the Washington press corps, which had overplayed each attack on Johnson's leadership, and then, after each one had failed, had conceded that his power was greater than ever, agreed with Time's assessment that Johnson is, without rival, the dominant face of the Democratic 85th Congress. As such, he does indeed stand second in power only to the President of the U.S. Asking, "Who is the most powerful man in the United States today?" Stuart Alsop, in January 1959, answered his own question. "The President." "But," he added, "Senator Lyndon Baines Johnson certainly runs the President a close second, especially now that voters have given him a huge majority to lead. There are those who argue that Johnson is, in fact, if not in theory, the country's most powerful man, because he loves to exercise power, and President Eisenhower does not." But although during the final 3 years of his Senate career, Lyndon Johnson's power over the Senate was as great as ever, The legislative achievements of this last stage of his Senate career were in many ways no more than a reprise of his early years in the Senate. This late period opened with a repeat of the theme, preparedness, that had been so prominent during the early period, more full-throated but in most aspects remarkably similar to its earlier form. On October 4, 1957, during the Senate recess before the opening of the Senate's 1958 session, Russia launched Sputnik, traveling companion, the first man-made satellite to orbit the Earth. Americans were shocked, having been confident of their nation's technological and scientific superiority over the Soviet Union. A new age, the space age, had been launched, and it wasn't America that had launched it, but America's most feared enemy. Despite the Eisenhower administration's attempts to minimize the Soviet Union's achievement, Sherman Adams said that America was not about to play the Russians in an outer space basketball game. In the first excitement, its implications seemed ominous. The Russians had beaten America in the race to develop a missile capable of placing a satellite in orbit. Might they not also win in the race to develop a missile capable of delivering nuclear warheads? Lyndon Johnson was down on his ranch when the news came over the television late that afternoon. He was to recall that when, after dinner, he, Lady Bird, and their guests, Dale and Scooter Miller, took the evening walk on the dirt road next to the Pertinalis, they peered up at the dark hill country sky, unsuccessfully straining to catch a glimpse of that alien object among the sky full of stars. He felt, he was to recall, uneasy and apprehensive, as did much of America that night and in the weeks to come. The country's first reaction was an alarm that approached panic. In the excitement, it seemed that the administration had squandered America's lead in missilery, and that the nation had been caught unprepared as it had been 7 years earlier when communist troops in Korea had attacked without warning across the 38th parallel. With the nation possibly in danger, Richard Russell was again not the bigot, but the patriot. A patriot who, in love of his country, was pure of heart. On October 4th, Russell was back in the big white frame